This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Could BP be looking for some help?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico has so far cost the British oil giant more than $3 billion. Share prices have tumbled by half since the oil leak began 2.5 months ago. But today, investors smell rescue in the air, and in London anyway, are starting to buy those shares amid reports BP is looking for some outside help. Dow Jones reports this morning Libya's chief oil official is saying that a piece of BP would be a good buy for that country's sovereign wealth fund. And that's on top of another story we reported earlier that the company is looking at Middle Eastern investors to prop up its capital after so much has gushed away. Jeremy Batstone Carr is head of research at the UK brokerage firm Charles Stanley. He's with us live from London. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi.
The company has had this terrible disaster. Who in their right mind would want a piece of it?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that there's only a very cautious share price response to these rumors in the market in London. Shares are up about 3% or so, which is pretty small beer. Nonetheless, the share price has collapsed, as everybody knows. It is a distressed company. It's very unlikely to go bust. And what it has got and what global oil investors, sovereign wealth funds are interested in is what could be very sophisticated production technology. On that basis, a few buyers are beginning to show themselves, particularly, as you say, from the Middle East.
And say it doesn't get money from these outside investors, Jeremy, and becomes the target of some, hostile takeover. What happens to that extraordinary liability?
Clearly, if the worst were to come to the worst, which we and most people do not believe will happen, then obviously any potential buyer of the business would have to take on that liability. Nonetheless, bad as conditions are in both in the Gulf of Mexico and for BP, we do not think that the company is, frankly, in danger of collapse. I would say, just in passing, that if it were to collapse, the impact on the financial markets would probably be about 10 times worse than that of Lehman Brothers.
All right. Jeremy Batstone Carr in London. Thank you, sir. And here at home, the Senate again failed to pass an extension on long-term unemployment benefits. Now it's on to recess, so it'll be at least another week before they can try again, which means thousands of more people will keep running out of benefits. And that has serious consequences, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
So far, more than 1.7 million people have run out of unemployment benefits. That's according to the best estimates of the Labor Department, which collects data from all the states. The department thinks by the end of this week, more than 2.1 million people will have used them up.
They've already tapped into savings, retirement, you know, if there's any value in their homes.
Sylvia Allegretto is an economist at the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UC Berkeley. She says once those are gone, there's not much left.
Well, what's left is to find a job. But of course, we know there are very few jobs out there.
And she says the longer you've been out of work, the harder it is to find work, even if there are jobs to be had. A lot of people have already given up looking, which is one reason June's unemployment numbers weren't worse. Allegretto says the economy needs more stimulus right now, not less. Stimulus that could be as simple as extending unemployment benefits. Again, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, July 5th. On the other side of the globe, a day-long strike is taking place in India against high fuel prices. Last month, the government scrapped fuel subsidies and increased prices in an attempt to cut its budget deficit. But opposition parties who have called the strike say it's going to lead to high inflation. The BBC's Rahul Tandon is with us from Calcutta. Hi, Rahul.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Where are you right now?
I am near what would normally be a very, very busy road. You normally wouldn't be able to hear me, but because of the strike, there's no cars, there's no buses, there's nothing on the streets. Even the animals have gone home for the day. But in front of me, there are a few workers because there may be a strike, but they get paid a daily wage. They're the poorest of the poor. If they don't work, they don't get to eat, so they've had to break the strike.
And things sound pretty calm over there, Rahul. Has there been much chaos caused by the strike?
There has been across India. This is a country of more than a billion people. Imagine in the States, if all your major cities for a day had no schools, no cinemas, no shops, everything was shut down. Times that by four, a billion people have been trying to struggle to get to work. Most of them have given up. There's been some violence. India has been paralyzed.
And very quickly, Rahul, how badly have people been affected by these fuel price increases?
Very badly affected indeed. You know, they've gone up by about 8 to 9%. That means that all commodities have gone up. The government says, look, there's little they can do. They need to cut the deficit. You've heard about that in the States. Expect more strikes, more chaos in the world's biggest democracy.
The BBC's Rahul Tandon reporting for us from Calcutta. From Cape Cod to the wilds of Alaska, the National Park Service is responsible for preserving more than 80 million acres of scenic beauty from coast to coast. And as Gigi Duban reports from the Great Smoky Mountains in Tennessee, the job of park ranger is highly sought after these days.
Take me to the prettiest place in the park. Show me the best waterfall. Those are questions Carrie Jones gets asked dozens of times every day at Great Smoky Mountains National Park. The other question he hears all the time?
How do I get a job here? How do I get a job in environmental education or in the wildlife or helping the environment? Yeah, I hear that a lot. There's a lot more of that than there was, say, 10 years ago, I think.
Jones is a park ranger. He retired, then recently returned as a seasonal employee. As a ranger, he gets paid to hike through the woods, show people where salamanders hide, point out the difference between a black-capped chickadee and a Carolina chickadee. Not a bad gig. Jobs with the National Park Service have always been competitive, but recently the government agency has been flooded with applicants. In the Washington office alone, they're getting four times the number of applications than they did just a few years ago. One of those hopefuls is Jenny Bradbury. Bradbury is 25. She works at a real estate office renting cabins in nearby Gatlinburg. On her days off, she'd volunteer at the park.
It was really fun and rewarding for me. I feel like I learned a lot about the park and did some good networking.
It paid off. Bradbury just landed a job as a forestry technician with the Park Service. She has a degree in wildlife ecology, so for her, spraying plants and treating infested trees is exciting stuff. Her job is seasonal, so she won't have health insurance, and it pays just $15 an hour. But she says it's worth it.
You can make a difference, and it's nice to be outside and hike. I'm sure it'll be a lot of hard work, but probably rewarding work.
And for young people, rewarding work is what it's about, says Ryan Paw. He's co-founder of BrazenCareerist.com.
They want a work life that sort of enhances their personal life, and they're willing to take a lower salary because of that.
For Jones and Bradbury, 6 months of seasonal work is still work. And when that's up, they'll both be competing for another stint with the Park Service. In the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Monday, July 5th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look in the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. It's free agency time in the NBA. Teams are battling over the hottest crop of players in years. The biggest prize is Cleveland's LeBron James. The New York Knicks told LeBron coming to the Big Apple could mean a billion-dollar career. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich looks at how where you play shapes lifetime pay.
Let's be clear. Superstars like LeBron James and Dwayne Wade will be super rich wherever they play. We're talking the difference between $600 million and $1 billion. That'd be the lifetime bottom line for LeBron between Miami and New York. That's according to computer modeling commissioned by the Knicks. Cleveland and Chicago fell in between. Kevin McIntyre of the Leverage Sports Agency says it's largely about a city's potential for sponsorships and business deals.
You know, the people that you meet socially. He starts to get ingrained into other areas of business outside of just basketball.
Forbes magazine's Stephen Bertone got a hold of the Knicks' detailed PowerPoint for LeBron. Bertone says the size and personal wealth of the fan base factor in. So does desperation.
Their idea is the longer a city has gone without a championship, the more it's worth to that player because he would be, you know, the savior.
One thing not in that PowerPoint, the hometown weather. Because for an extra $400 million, who really cares? I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
The latest movie in the Twilight series grabbed top honors at the box office over the long holiday weekend. It took in about $69 million in North America alone. Advertisers knew the movie would do well and ponied up for product placement. Now, given the movie's target audience, shots of Burger King make sense. But what's Volvo doing in there? April Dembosky has the story.
Volvo has built its reputation on safety and sensibility. The name conjures images of soccer moms and station wagons, not tween girls who don't even have their license yet. But it was Twilight author Stephanie Meyer who put her lead vampire behind the wheel of a Volvo, so the company seized on the marketing opportunity when the book became a movie. Now it's trying to appeal to teens and their so-called twi moms.
Our car is much more than just safety.
Linda Gangieri is a Volvo spokeswoman.
And it really is about this idea of being perceived as a cool, attractive brand.
Stanford marketing professor Jennifer Auker says Volvo's cameo in the Twilight series should help it achieve the kind of cachet all companies want.
One is to be a little bit more exciting, and the second is to have a better stronghold on a younger consumer base.
Vampires, werewolves, and hordes of squealing 12-year-old girls should help do it. I'm April Dembosky for Marketplace.
The internet has created a tough time in the newspaper business, something former Miami Herald columnist Dave Barry devotes a section to in his new book, I'll Mature When I'm Dead. Dave Barry is with us right now. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey.
So part of your book is a comedic look at the collapsing newspaper industry. This is an industry that you've been a part of for almost four decades now. I mean, how much responsibility do you take for its demise?
I mean, can't be mere coincidence that when I stopped writing my column, the entire industry collapsed. But I think part of it was, this is an object lesson in the danger of allowing any industry to be run by English majors.
What is it about English majors? Why?
I don't know. I am one. I was one, and we graduate from college with, I think, a minimal grasp of how anything economic works. And so, you know, when the internet came along and we were challenged and we met it in true English major style by holding lots of meetings and conferences. And we tried various approaches. One was to we went through a phase in the 90s where we pretended there was no internet. You know, internet? What internet? And then for a while we tried to make our newspapers look like they were internet, constantly redesign them with more graphics and shorter stories.
But you can't click anything.
Exactly. It's a special kind of internet where it doesn't actually work. You can't click on anything and there's no way that it can be interactive or change. And now our approach is trying to figure out how we can make money giving away our product for free. Anybody out there with any ideas, let us know. Thanks. Thanks a lot. I speak on behalf of the whole newspaper industry.
Well, because I want some sliver of information to come out of this interview.
That's going to be tough.
That our audience can learn and obviously from this.
Capital of Vermont, Montpelier.
How do you save the newspaper industry? You have to have an idea or two.
I really don't. Really? I really don't. I think what's going to save it, if you want me to actually attempt to give you an answer.
Please.
It's going to be somebody like Google, you know, some company that has actual expertise at extracting money from people who use the internet, because somebody will have to. I mean, if we're going to have journalism, I don't think newspapers will survive. The goal now is to see figure out a way for journalism to survive, which means somebody has to pay for it. And I don't think the newspaper industry knows how to do that.
Well, ending on that positive note, Dave Barry.
And not only that, eventually the sun will turn into a cold, dark cinder. Other than that, though, I think things are looking pretty good.
Dave Barry, humor columnist, syndicated for how long, we don't know. But
thousands of years.
We thank you for being with us.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
And finally, earlier this year, Chad Etmuller walked into a Georgia sandwich shop, ordered a double five meat special with cheese. When he tried to eat it, his jaw temporarily locked up. Instead of suing, AOL reports he went back to the store and asked for a free sandwich to replace the one he couldn't eat. A chain restaurant called Witch Witch gave him the sandwich and then renamed the sandwich the Lockjaw. The company says because of the notoriety from the incident, it's expanding its presence in Georgia. Ed Mueller says he may even open his own franchise, and he has plans to attend the company's annual convention in Dallas. Not bad for biting off more than he could chew. This is the Marketplace Midday Update in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.